of Vicky Paw.
Hi guys, my name is Caitlin. I'm an alcoholic. I would like to apologize to those who've never been to a young people's meeting, right? I do take the steps and traditions very seriously, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is May the 4th, be with you, 2019. And I have a sponsor who knows she's my sponsor. And my home group that I got sober in is the Tuesday night Fountain Valley, Thy Will Not Mine Be Done, women's third step study, where they took me through the first three steps. They also volunteered me to get a service position right away. So at 60 days sober, I became a GSR. And then I also have a service sponsor. She's taking me through the world concepts and traditions and a lot of the different pamphlets, and you know, also volunteered me until she did it, until I, you know, volunteered myself to take on different service positions in Alcoholics Anonymous. So to qualify a little bit of what it was like, it was really bad. it took a lot of bitter experience for me to get here. I really thought that it was all of these outside things, the reason why I drank so much, right? As a result of my drinking or not drinking, right, I had a lot of bad things that have happened. And so as early as I can remember, right, I wanted to try to change the way I felt. And the first time that I picked up that first form of alcohol was at the age of 13. I had everything pretty much that was offered to me at the time, right? I think I was like in eighth grade, doing all of these extracurricular activities. My parents were, you know, church members. I had an older brother and sister who were good examples. And there was no reason for me to like really want to cause any trouble, but that seems to be a lot of what has happened in my story and what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So the next thing that I feel like happened for me, right, is that I decided to come up with this lie at about the age of 15, have all my girlfriends over, and pop open a bottle of Tobin James that had a signature on the bottle. I didn't know it was special to my mother at the time. And they were out of town, and so we had all planned and like lied and decided to meet at my parents' house. I was supposed to be staying with my grandma. She trusted me at the time, you know, and everybody else's parents, they all knew that my parents were out of town and just allowed them over. And we took my dad's Miata out for a little joyride around the neighborhood. It was the first time I stole his car. There was plenty of times where I did that in my story. And yeah, so I just, even though like I had like this life, I don't know, this like front that I was putting on, right? Like getting good grades, being involved in like leadership, cheer, all of these extracurricular activities, all of these things that I felt like at the time my mom was like keeping me involved so that I wouldn't cause like any trouble in their lives, right? And really, my perception has changed now. They really just wanted the best for me. And I remember, because we talk about it to this day, right, with my mom, where she's like, you know, you always used to complain that I used to force you to do these things, but these were always things that you wanted to do, you know, and I was never satisfied at a very young age. So my drinking didn't really get bad. I had like a lot of fear living in a Catholic home. I barely wanted to open the windows at night because my dad was really scary. And I didn't want him to think that I was trying to sneak out, even though there were plenty of attempts. And so I kept like my alcoholism, the allergy, it wasn't on and cracking at that point. So, you know, there was a few parties that I had attended, still full of fear, still not like wanting to get in too much trouble and still wanting to like participate in all of these things. It wasn't until, you know, I started to attend college, right, at the age of 18, I got accepted to Fresno State. And I didn't realize that you had to go to class in order to get a degree, right? So I was just going to all the frat parties and the football games and all the fun stuff. And that was the one and only time that I got arrested, was at a Fresno State game, actually, for a drunk in public. Luckily, my friend had my purse with my ID and everything, but they had told me that the police came in the bathroom. I had hit my head on the floor. And they dragged me down, or like through a golf cart, right, from the very top up there, if you guys have ever been to a Fresno State game, all the way down. So all my friends got to see everything, right? Incomprehensible demoralization. That was not the end of that. And so I remember waking up in a jail cell, and there was another individual in there, and I was like really scared. And I didn't understand like how I had got there. And, you know, my friends, we all talked about it after, and we were really late to the pregame. And so we thought if we just drink it a little bit faster, that the effects would hit a little bit quicker. But for me, I ended up just throwing up in the back of a cop car and in jail. So they let me out. They just let me dry out, right? It really wasn't jail, technically, right? Just the drunk tank. And I went immediately out after. My parents were out of town at the time, too. I was still living with them. And I went right out to a party, you know, and I thought that I was like this hero, and I thought it was funny, you know? And so I knew that, like, I had had a problem really young, you know? I just, like, wasn't really willing to admit it yet. I thought that this was all things that people were doing at my age. And, you know, I thought it was the people, places, and things that were all the problem, too. So I told my parents that I dropped out of college and that I really wanted to go to beauty school and that I wasn't going to do what they wanted me to do, even though I was an adult and I had a free choice at the time, right? But they could already see that my life was starting to go downhill from that point. And so they told me that I couldn't live there unless I had a full-time job or I was going to school. And so I decided to move out of my parents' house for the first time, got my own apartment, was working three jobs, riding my bike, all these places, and I was going to prove them wrong. And things just got a little bit better, right? I did go to beauty school. I met a really nice boy there, right? And actually, you know, I stole him from another girl that was attending the school there, and he liked to party the same way that I liked to party. And that's where I was introduced to other forms of alcohol. And that was something that I really, really enjoyed. And eventually I had to take a leave of absence from that beauty school, got pregnant, and I was living this fairy tale dream, right? Like I thought I had found my Prince Charming and he was gonna protect me from these bad Catholic parents. And you know, that just wasn't the case. Things, they eventually just continued to get worse and worse and worse. I did finish beauty school, I will say that, and I started working in a salon at a Supercuts in River Park. I was there for a couple years. I was able to scrape together like a few material things. I was able to get into management where I used my office to do other forms of alcohol and drink, you know, off and on the clock while taking clients. And just a little side story too, I actually ran into one of my clients who didn't realize, we ran into each other in one of these rooms, right? And she didn't realize that I had a problem. It wasn't until I moved back to this area and we were able to like make an amends to each other. So that was really cool, a cool gift of this program. And so backing up just a little bit, I think it was at about 5 years that I was a licensed cosmetologist. I had tried like all of these other things, remove myself from the people that I didn't want to continue to drink with, right? Because it was just on the weekends, and then it was, okay, Thirsty Thursday, and then it was Wild Wednesday, and then it was Friday night, and then it was every single day of the week, right, that I was going out, and I was getting drunk. And so I finally got into this management position after 5 years of being with that company, and I thought that I just, like, needed that change of scenery, new friends, and so there was another employee of mine that I worked with, and she and her boyfriend at the time, like, we would go to the gym. So I tried like all these alternative methods, right? And that kept me like abstinent, right? Like I didn't use or drink any form of alcohol during that period of time, and like life got a little bit better. And you know, I don't know, right? That feeling, that restless, irritable, and discontentness, it started to creep back in. I didn't want anything to do with like any spiritual way of life or going back to the Catholic Church. I didn't want to like believe in that God that I had grew up with. And I didn't really want structure, right? Like any good alcoholic, we're undisciplined. And so eventually, right, like I decided to pick up a form of alcohol you know, that basically brought my life completely down within a year and a half. I had, you know, again, materialized some things. I had a house, a single parent at the time, after like going through like all this huge custody battle, domestic violence, lots of that in my story as well. And that was like a plausible alibi that I used for a really long time to continue to get loaded, right? Because I couldn't deal with the feelings, couldn't deal with life. And so, you know, after that year and a half, after I picked up that form of alcohol, yeah, things got really wild. This is about the time when I stole my dad's car for the second time. This time I didn't just drive it around the block. I took it all the way down Route 66 and made it to Arkansas. And I just told him that I needed to take a friend somewhere, you know, and I couldn't make it back. You know, when it talks about in the book, like, we can't meet those important dates, right? Like, I had left my son with his dad's mom, his grandma, and I couldn't make it back. It took me about a whole extra week to make it back, right? And I was with a group of people, so of course, naturally, I blame them, right? Because they get loaded way more than I do, or so I thought at the time. And I remember, like, on that drive back, we were coming through Vegas, and my dad was, like, threatening to call the police and reporting the car stolen. And I got off the phone with him, and, you know, eventually I did make it back, right? But I just remember that thought of, like, how could I leave my son and not make it back? You know, he was the most important thing in my life at the time. The love for him couldn't even bring me back. You know, this disease had, like, that much of a grip on me. And, you know, it didn't stop there for me. I feel like a few months after that, right, my house was raided by the bounty hunters, because any good ride or die, right, that's the kind of relationship that I acquire when I'm out there getting loaded, right, is I think that I'm going to ride or die for the guy that I'm with, and I'm going to bail him out of jail, not just one time, but three times. So, of course, the bounty hunters are going to come knocking on my door looking for him. And he was hiding in the neighbor's attic, and I just told them, you know, like, I wanted nothing to do with him. I actually, like, just threw a bottle of alcohol at his head right before I kicked him out, and he saw, like, the bounty hunters coming. You know, and then something inside me, right, just felt like, okay, I'd done this before. You know, I had cleaned up the past with my son's dad, gotten out of that, like, abusive situation. I can do this again, right? Like, I have all the material things. I know how to work. I know how to do all the stuff. Like, let me just start over. You know, and at the time, my sister, she lived in Long Beach, California. And so I called her. Yeah, that's right. I called her to ask her if my son could come there for a week, because I had this bright idea, right, that I could just clean up all of the alcohol, all the forms of alcohol in my house. And let me tell you, I thought that I was Bob the Builder and that I was really doing it. I had all kinds of things going on and crafts and all kinds of stuff. So there was a lot of wreckage that needed to be cleaned up in my house. And so she agreed to that, right? This was the last year, too, that my son could attend the preschool that she worked at. That's like a God shot, right? Because I don't think... If that wasn't the case, I was so scared to, like, take him anywhere at a certain point, right? Because I knew that they were about to take him from me, because I couldn't, you know, I wasn't a safe person. And so, you know, she agreed to that. I drove him down there, and he was there for a week, came home, got loaded a little bit more, right? Ended up having a couple of people clean my house with me. And, of course, again, that important date to be met. I was about a couple days late to go pick up my son. And when I got there, my son was not there. You know, my family finally, like, had enough. They saw what was going on. I was 95 pounds soaking wet at the time, and I was really sick, you know. So they decided that that was the best course of action, to remove anything from my life in order to be able to give me a chance. That's what they thought that they could do, and that's all that they knew how to do for me at the time. And so, I went to my aunt's house, who lives in Seal Beach, and she told me I needed to go to detox, that I needed to get help, and all of the things. And when I made an amends to her later, too, right, like, in my head, I thought it only took her about 30, 20 minutes of convincing me to go to this hospital and talk to these doctors and When I got to like do a direct amends to her, she told me, you know, took you 4 hours of convincing, right? Like that's how delusional I was. That's how my perception was. And I had no idea, you know, that I was like really kicking and screaming that hard. So, you know, like any good alcoholic too, I get taken to a hospital and then I lie to the doctors. So I couldn't be honest. I couldn't be rigorously honest at the time. And I really just thought that like I could do this thing on my own. I wasn't willing to accept help, right? Like I thought I was this strong, independent woman, and that wasn't the case. Like I was just really sick. And so, you know, my aunt, I had finally come clean, right, that I had a problem, that I was like using all these forms of alcohol. And you know, when you go to a detox, they ask you too, like, are you doing any opiates? Are you doing any of this, X, Y, and Z? And I'm like, how dare you? I just told you I had a problem, you know? Like, no, I'm not doing any of that. And I had been lying this whole time, right? So again, delusional thinking, thinking that I'm coming clean. You don't need to know what I've done. I wasn't an opiate user, but my aunt at the time too, she told me, you know, I'm not gonna be responsible for your death if you can't be honest with these doctors. You're not coming home with me. And she put me up in a hotel room, and I didn't know where my son was still, had no idea. And so like that scared me enough, right? To get sober once more, abstinent, right? Not like spiritually sober or anything to do with the 12 steps. I wasn't introduced to that yet. And so that same guy that my house was raided by the bounty hunters, right? He comes all the way from Fresno to pick me up and Orange County, and I blame him for my son being taken, and I blame everybody else. You know, like if you knew the problems that I had and why I was continuing to do what I did, you would drink too. You know, and I detoxed on the side of the 99 out there by the Motel 6. Yeah, it was great times. And I was calling my family every single day, you know, telling them, like, I'm sober now. I'm good. Like I've even gained a little bit of weight in the couple of days, right? And it took 9 days of me thinking that I was convincing them, but really they had convinced me to accept medical help. And so they only agreed for me to see my son if I signed over a temporary guardianship and had it notarized. So I had a choice to pick which family member that would be too. And so I signed over a temporary guardianship to my parents. Had it notarized in Long Beach when we went back down because my son was still with my sister. And I got to see my son for about an hour before I got on a plane to go to my first treatment center. And I went to a treatment center in Arizona. I basically, again, you know, my family, they really needed Al-Anon at the time, I felt like. And I was just talking to somebody else earlier that when I was in these treatment centers, they used to bring Al-Anon in, and I used to ask them, like, how do I get my family to work these steps, because I don't need to work them, they need to work them, you know? And it was just crazy, right? So, but yeah, so like my family even at the time too, right? I think we heard earlier, it was like a $30,000 big book, you know, that they paid for, and they would bring my son out almost every single weekend. They would put him on a plane so that I could see him for the family weekends, and I was still super ungrateful, and I was still super resentful, and still upset. And I thought that I was the warden of that treatment center, right? I was really upset when they didn't take us out to go get cigarettes, so I took somebody that was on 2 days of detox down the street, right? Like, I am that rebel alcoholic. And we walked all the way down the street to the liquor store to grab our pack of cigarettes because they wouldn't allow us to do that, you know? Because we're not children. This is, like, all the mentality that I had. And, you know, I also have another illness, too. I have an autoimmune disease, so, of course, once, like, I'm removed from all the drugs and the alcohol, right, like, I start to, like, feel a little bit better, and then all of the medical issues that I hadn't been taking care of, right, they're starting to pop up again. And my family was always willing to, like, front the cost of, like, anything, right? They just wanted me to be well, and I somehow convinced them that I needed to come back to California and go to another treatment center because I had insurance in California and not in Arizona. And so they did that, right? I did 30 days at Canyon Vista in Arizona, and they put me back on a plane. I stayed overnight at my parents' house, somehow convinced my dad to take me out to the 99 too to say bye to my boy toy that I had at the time. Just no other like care in the world for anybody else at all, you know, just really sick. And, you know, my dad, he drove me all the way down to this treatment center in Orange County. And I left out too, right? When I was in that treatment center, I got a sponsor. Her name was Ashley. She would come. She was through H&I. She would come and she would do the steps with me too. And I got to that fourth step, and that's when I seemed to like bounce from treatment center to treatment center. I'm constantly like running from that fourth step, you know? I had this idea of Alcoholics Anonymous that, you know, the fourth step, you're gonna rip it up, we're gonna burn it, and it's gonna all go up into flames, you know, and then I'm gonna be cured. I don't know what I was thinking, right? But that's not the way it works, I've come to find out. And, you know, so again, I moved to this other treatment center in Orange County, and I get another sponsor. She was like a real hard ass sponsor too. She did not want me wasting her time, and she definitely disturbed me on the question of my alcoholism, and I still was not willing to take the cotton out of my ears and put it in my mouth and sit down and shut up and do the work at the time. So she really did plant that seed though, right? So I do another 30 days at this treatment center in, it's Casa Capri down in Orange County. And they decided they wanted to keep me there another 90 days, you know, and I was not going to do that either. I was, like, still mentally coming back from everything as well. And I was like, what? You guys want to keep me locked up here? Even though at this treatment center there were no gates, right? We were like, in apartments. It was very nice. But for some reason, I thought that I was, like, in this prison, you know? And so... I believe it was on like the 29th day at this treatment center, I had like 59 days sober. I called up that boy Toy again. You know, he was making his plan to go hop the border to Mexico. He was already like down in the area, and I'm like, can you swoop me up? Because they want to keep me locked up in here, and I'm just not going to do that. So I ran out the front of these apartments and like hopped in his car, and we like sped away. And, I somehow like picked up my car that was being held together by zip ties in the front, just all this wild stuff, and I had this plan, right? I needed to go back to Arizona. It was cheaper for me to live there. I was able to take care of my son. Again, I know how to work. I know how to get a job. I know what I'm doing. You know, I just wasn't willing to like hear anything else. You know, I just need to like remove. I need to do another geographical. You know, and this is how I know, too, in this part of my story that I have that alcoholic thinking, because at the time, I had been entirely abstinent, but I had been acting out in these behaviors that, you know, I thought that I was only doing because I was drinking and getting loaded, right? And, you know, later when I actually had done a thorough fourth and fifth step with a sponsor, right, it was clear to me that I do have that thinking of an alcoholic. Like, I'm still making these poor choices even sober. You know, so sobriety is not enough for me. Meetings were definitely not enough for me. Like, I was trying to live vicariously through all of you who looked happy and were laughing while I was sitting there crying for 60 days. And so during that little escapade, right, like, I probably adventured back to Fresno, between Fresno and Arizona, all these places with that boyfriend who was trying to collect some money by obviously not doing it the conventional way. And he was making a plan to like cross the border and live a happily ever after in Mexico. And there was still something in me that was like, okay, I need to eventually make it back to a sober living, call my family maybe. Then I was just asking them for things. And I remember too being so resentful at them at this point in my story too, because they all had gone on vacation and didn't invite me, and I felt like that was very hurtful. I'm like, how dare you not invite me to like go hang out with you guys? You guys are my family, right? And they're posting pictures all over Facebook, my son, and I'm just like missing out on all of these things, you know? And I'm like sober, stone cold sober at the time. And yeah, I don't know, something eventually, I eventually did get back into a sober living. I got another job as a hairstylist in Arizona, stayed there for a little bit. But again, right, I love a man who can sell me a dream. And so I was on the phone with that same guy who had finally made it across the border. And he told me, you know, we were going to live happily ever after. I could bring my son there and we were going to have a good old time. And so I made my way down to Tijuana I ran out of that sober living as well. I don't know why. The doors were unlocked. Just ran and jumped into cars. I think that's just what I was used to with who I was hanging out with. And, you know, I got in the car, drove to Mexico, and when I got there, I'll never forget this, right? Like, we lived in this apartment that was over an AA room there, right? And I was, he was like, babe, you can go to meetings. Like, it's going to be good. I'm going to get loaded. You're going to stay sober. It's better for you. I've been doing this a lot longer than you, and, like, I don't want to hang out with you when you're getting loaded, so you need to stop. And he thought that he was going to, like, will me to stay sober, too, and it just doesn't work that way. So, again, there's still a little bit of domestic violence, not only on his part, but on mine as well, right? Because I pick up all of these behaviors to protect myself from all the things that I put myself through, sober again. And, you know, one last time, right, like I cross over the border, I make a phone call to my dad because I'm out of money, and I ask him if I can come home to Fresno. And he, at the time, sent me some money, $40, to make it back to Fresno. And I drove back, and I remember sleeping in their guest room. And, of course, they have all these rules. I think they had gone to, like, another I think it was Narcanon, something, pain, whatever, like, parent support group that they could go to, church, all the things, right? And they told me I couldn't be in their house if I was loaded. And I still had that fear of them, so I wanted to, like, respect them. So eventually, like, I stopped coming back because I was always getting loaded again, you know? And that was the first time, too, right, like, where my ego was truly smashed. I had, like, this aha moment. This thought came to mind, and I started Googling different ways that I could take my own life, right? Like, that's where my alcoholism takes me. I'm truly bedeviled. It talks about the untreated alcoholism on page 52, and I was there. You know, I thought so highly of myself. Like, why would I be thinking about taking my own life? And it was just a thought, constant thought, you know, at this point. And I remember, too, a resentment from my mom. She was telling me how to make a lunch for my son, and that was, like, the thing that took me out last, right? I couldn't fathom the fact that she, you know, thought that she knew better than me. I know how to make a sandwich for my kid, you know, but I didn't realize until I'd done the work that I hadn't been doing it for years. You know, so once more, I had another bright idea to go to a treatment center where they took women and children. And by this point, right, like, I'm running around the streets of Fresno thinking I'm the leader of all the gangs there, hanging out with violent criminals, just not good stuff. Police officers are pulling me over because they're recognizing the people that are getting into my car, and they're asking me if I need help, right, because I don't have a record. I didn't even have a speeding ticket at the time, now that I do in sobriety, but, you know, at the time there was no reason, right? And I just felt like I had all of these God shots too, and there was people, you know, even out there in the streets the very last time too, when I was out there, that were telling me I didn't belong out there, that I had something to live for, and that I had a son to take care of, and that if I continued to hang out with them long enough, that I was going to end up just like them. And so, there was a lot of people, you know, a lot of signs that I needed to go back to treatment, you know. So I finally got into this treatment center for women and children. And at the time, too, my son's father decided that he wanted to come back and be a full-time dad in my son's life. And he was court-ordered to have him on the weekends. And so at this point, I didn't have two pennies to rub together. I didn't have a cell phone that was working. My hair was crazy. I definitely have a few treatment center mugshots. And, you know, I just kind of stopped fighting at that point in time. I had called the couple of sponsors, too. I still had their numbers to ask them to help me. And they were like, you need to go to the Lynn House. You need to go here. You need to go to all these places, right? We can't help you. You're still getting loaded. And so I just had all of this direction, you know, and so, you know, at the time, of course, like, I'm super bitter because my parents are rule followers and my son's dad hadn't been following the court order this entire time, right? And so how dare they follow the rules now? Why do we have to be the rule followers? You know, I need to see my son. I need to, like, have him in my life, you know, but I feel like now looking back on it, God was removing everything again for me to be able to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools that had been laid at my feet, over and over and over again by different women in this program. And so there was a couple of times, you know, where I was able to see my son, and the sponsor that I was working with at the time, she told me to like put everything on a shelf, and that I had nothing else left to do, right? So I better get to work. And she asked me if I was gonna do that fourth step that we never finished the last time when I was down there in Orange County. I finished that fourth step before I left that treatment center. I was there for 60 days. And you know, it came choice for me to like have that exit plan with like a counselor. I had like run out of insurance, you know, and my sponsor suggested to me that I go to the sober living called Thy Will Not Mine Be Done Women's House. It's a two-bedroom apartment where seven women are living. And they were really structured. They told me I was going to sleep on a top bunk so I could get closer to God. And, you know, I just said yes and okay at that point because I had nothing else to do. And my parents at the time weren't even picking up the phone for me to call and talk to my son, but she just kept giving me that direction, right? Like, you had been so irresponsible, you had been so unreliable, you had been all of these things, they're not gonna pick up the phone for you right away, right? All you can do is keep your side of the street clean and continue to like take this action, contrary action, right? So she gave me the direction too, because you know, I had been rocketed into this work because I was ready to just like get it over with, right? We had did a fourth, a fifth, six, seven, and eight before I left that treatment center. And when I got to that sober living, I started to make some of my financial amends, you know, because my idea was that I needed to get my finances in order again to take care of my son. That was still like at the forefront of my mind. And so started to do that, and also to sit down and make direct amends with those who are willing to hear it. And this sponsor, she told me too, right? Like, the ninth step is not for you. You're not gonna get any relief, especially after hearing your fifth step, right? You're probably not gonna get as much relief as you hear other people say because you've caused a lot of harm and you've created a lot of wreckage, but this is for the other person, right? So you're gonna write this letter. You're going to say, you know, these are the things that I have done. Is there anything that you feel like I have left out? And then give them the opportunity to speak and then shut up and not say anything, not rebuttal anything, and just hear what they have to say. And then just ask them what you can do to make it right once they're done. You know, and that was the direction that I was given. And, you know, that seemed to work, right? I didn't get like a lot of gifts back immediately. You know, eventually I was able to build some trust back with my parents, with my family. They started calling me on my birthday and stuff like that again. But, you know, I consistently called them every single day to either read a book with my son on the phone or just to talk to them. And sometimes they wouldn't answer still, and I just had to, like, learn to accept that, right? And again, like, I got really busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor also told me, too, like, if I'm not inconvenienced by AA, then I'm not doing it right. And so I was in H&I, Intergroup, GSR, all the things, right? I had a meeting every single day. She said, you're going to do Monday things on Monday, Tuesday things on Tuesday, and you're going to continue to say yes and okay. And for some reason, like, I just kept following her suggestion, and I needed that hardcore, you know, direction, right? Because I am undisciplined to a T, and I don't listen to anybody. So the fact that I was listening to her was a miracle. I really do owe my life to this sponsor too, right? Because you know, she tricked me with the God thing, you know? She just kept telling me to read these pages out of the big book. And there were pages 60 to 63, portion of 67, 76, 84 through 89, page 417, 164. And that was what my meditation was every single day when I woke up, and I had other women in my fellowship that I would call and we would read these pages because I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know how to have a relationship with a higher power. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff, right? I didn't know that I could create my own conception of a God and that I could rely on that, you know, have like that loving and trusting relationship that I'm safe and protected. I didn't understand that concept when I got here. And so she just kept encouraging me to do that. And then when I would call her and I would complain about things, right? Even I'm like getting on the bus, they're like sponsoring me to, like, scholarshiping me to be at this sober living, right, until I can, like, pay them back. They're fronting me this money. So I get on the bus to like my little jobby poo, my little get well job. That's like revolved around my AA life, right? And you know, I'm like complaining to her any chance that I get, and she was like, "All right, you know, who are you helping? And where are you at with God?" And she just kept repeating that over and over and over again to me until about 2 years sober. And you know, there's been a lot of things that have happened in my sobriety, right? It really is true when it talks about the 12th suggestion of having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. That happened for me, right? When I took my first sponsee through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was getting on the bus just like I was with my sponsor, Chelsea. She was willing to meet me anywhere. She was just as desperate as I was, and I got to see her life change, and I got to see her make amends to her family. And I remember when I would call Chelsea and be like, "I don't know, I think I'm gonna kill this girl." She was like, "You're not that important. You're not God. Just read the book with her." And I don't know why, you know, I have this God complex. It's one of my character defects. And so, you know, I've gotten to see like a lot of gifts, miracles of this program, you know, by continuing to work with others and sponsor other women in this program. And then also to be reminded too, right, of like what this disease really is. I've had grand sponsees that have, you know, but not able to be rigorously honest, or, you know, not continue to stay building their foundation, and died, right? They've gone out and they've died, and that's the reality of this program, right? So a little bit about where I am currently, right? I'm the current chair for the FICCIPAW committee, Young People's, right? I hated Young People's when I got here. I love GSR, I love history, and I thought that I was going to be in GSR forever. And, you know, I did a two-year term for District 18, which is Costa Mesa, Newport. And then I was elected to the board as the alternate DCM. And, you know, that was, like, a great experience, right? We got to, like, plan an ASC, and, like, in the middle of that, too, I didn't get to finish out my two-year term there. But it's because I had moved back to Fresno. So I've also moved in sobriety, right? And that was like a really big lesson for me to learn too, that I was putting a lot of my reliance upon people still, human aid. And it tells me that in the book, like if I continue to do that, like I could eventually get drunk again, right? And so I've had a lot of growth in like my spiritual life as a result of moving back to Fresno, California. Who would have thunk it? And being involved in Young People's, right, and all of these relationships that I created, because I thought the only way that I could stay sober was by this hardcore women's group that I was a part of and, like, doing AA alcoholically, you know. And I had to, like, sit down and pause, and I just remember talking to Chelsea and, like, telling her, like, "I'm not going to make it here," you know. And she was like, "This is an opportunity for you to actually figure out how to pray and reflect." Like, we had continued to have these same conversations over and over again, right? She was just redirecting me back to God. And so I asked another woman here to take me through the steps again. I did not finish, if I'm being honest. It was the BBA. I don't know if anybody's heard of that. I got to that four-step fears inventory, and I did not complete, but I was able to do like another thorough second and third step with her, right, because we went through the steps a little bit more slowly this time, and I was able to slow down and actually, like, create this relationship. All of these prejudices and against, like, religious principles and ideas that I had once had, you know, this Catholic God, like, all of these things, like, started to melt away, you know. And I did, of course, like, an ideal mates list. I have done 3-4 steps in my current sobriety. And obviously all the maintenance steps, right? And, you know, she told me that I wasn't nice to men, right? And that I didn't treat them like they were people. And I was, like, really harsh and ugly, cold-hearted when I came into these rooms. And I feel like I've had, like, this whole new experience, you know? And I don't know. I also am getting back into GSR in this area. I love any opportunity to be of service. I also want to thank, like, the host committee for having us Young Peoples out here. Again, apologies to those who did not like our yelling. I promise you, it's all good fun. We're not a glum lot, and I do take this very seriously. But I hope to continue to always keep service at the forefront of everything, and to continue to carry this message, right? My favorite prayer in Alcoholics Anonymous is the responsibility pledge, right? And after going like through all of these traditions and concepts with my service sponsor, right? Like, she tells me not to be a bleeding deacon. And she tells me, you know, like, I need to just be giving, like, informed stuff. And I just feel like there's so much history and knowledge to learn at Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you are new here in this program, or if you're fairly new, right, like, I suggest that you you grab somebody who looks like they have a working knowledge of the book, right? Find your place in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anybody is always welcome at WIPAW. You know, it's a good way to start getting into service and learning about what the service structure is about and how donating up the service structure starts and all the events and all the fun stuff that you can have and branching out. There's H&I, intergroup, all of these things, right? So I just suggest, like, if you're in a lot of pain, right, like, you just get with somebody, right? We're available. And then also, too, if you're a woman in this room and you're looking for a sponsor, I am more than willing and able to sponsor you, even be a service sponsor if you need that as well. I have taken a couple people through the world concepts and tradition, so I'd be happy to do that again because I love all of that stuff. And I want to thank you guys all again for letting me be of service, and that is all I have. Thank you.